Welcome to The Great Stories. I'm Trev Downey, and each week I'll read and then discuss a truly great short story by one of the iconic authors. Who doesn't enjoy being told a tale? Humans have been telling each other yarns as long as language itself has existed. Stories to entertain, to inspire, to frighten, and to teach. On this podcast, there will be no academic elitism. We will focus only on the story you'll be told, the context in which it appeared, and the author responsible for its creation. The Great Stories, you see, is for everyone. So, gather round, and let's enjoy this episode's tale. Beach Sounds by Octavia Butler. There was trouble aboard the Washington Boulevard bus. Rye had expected trouble sooner or later in her journey. She had put off going until loneliness and hopelessness drove her out. She believed she might have one group of relatives left alive, a brother and his two children 20 miles away in Pasadena. That was a day's journey one way, if she were lucky. The unexpected arrival of the bus as she left her Virginia Road home had seemed to be a piece of luck, until the trouble began. Two young men were involved in a disagreement of some kind, or, more likely, a misunderstanding. They stood in the aisle grunting and gesturing at each other, each in his own uncertain T-stance as the bus lurched over the potholes. The driver seemed to be putting some effort into keeping them off balance. Still, their gestures stopped just short of contact, mock punches, hand games of intimidation to replace lost curses. People watched the pair, then looked at one another and made small, anxious sounds. Two children whimpered. Rye sat a few feet behind the disputants and across from the back door. She watched the two carefully, knowing the fight would begin when someone's nerve broke or someone's hand slipped, or someone came to the end of his limited ability to communicate. These things could happen any time. One of them happened as the bus hit an especially large pothole, and one man, tall, thin, and sneering, was thrown into his shorter opponent. Instantly, the shorter man drove his left fist into the disintegrating sneer. He hammered his larger opponent as though he neither had nor needed any weapon other than his left fist. He hit quickly enough, hard enough, to batter his opponent down before the taller man could regain his balance or hit back even once. People screamed or squawked in fear. Those nearby scrambled to get out of the way. Three more young men roared in excitement and gestured wildly. Then, somehow, a second dispute broke out between two of these three, probably because one had inadvertently touched or hit the other. As the second fight scattered frightened passengers, a woman shook the driver's shoulder and grunted as she gestured toward the fighting. The driver grunted back through bared teeth. Frightened, the woman drew away. Rye, knowing the methods of bus drivers, braced herself and held on to the crossbar of the seat in front of her. When the driver hit the brakes, she was ready and the combatants were not. They fell over seats and onto screaming passengers, creating even more confusion. At least one more fight started. The instant the bus came to a full stop, Rye was on her feet, pushing the back door. At the second push, it opened and she jumped out, holding her pack in one arm. Several other passengers followed, but some stayed on the bus. Buses were so rare and irregular now. People rode when they could, no matter what. There might not be another bus today or tomorrow. People started walking, and if they saw a bus, they flagged it down. People making intercity trips like Rye's from Los Angeles to Pasadena made plans to camp out or risked seeking shelter with locals who might rob or murder them. The bus did not move, but Rye moved away from it. She intended to wait until the trouble was over and get on again, but if there was shooting, she wanted the protection of a tree. Thus, she was near the curb when a battered blue Ford on the other side of the street made a U-turn and pulled up in front of the bus. Cars were rare these days, as rare as a severe shortage of fuel and of relatively unimpaired mechanics could make them. Cars that still ran were as likely to be used as weapons as they were to serve as transportation. Thus, when the driver of the Ford beckoned to Rye, she moved away warily. The driver got out, a big man, young, neatly bearded, with dark, thick hair. He wore a long overcoat and a look of wariness that matched Rye's. She stood several feet from him, waiting to see what he would do. He looked at the bus, now rocking with the combat inside, then at the small cluster of passengers who'd gotten off. Finally, he looked at Rye again. She returned his gaze, very much aware of the old 45 automatic her jacket concealed. She watched his hands. He pointed with his left hand toward the bus. The dark, tinted windows prevented him from seeing what was happening inside. His use of the left hand interested Rye more than his obvious question. Left-handed people tended to be less impaired, more reasonable and comprehending, less driven by frustration, confusion and anger. She imitated his gesture, pointing toward the bus with her own left hand, then punching the air with both fists. The man took off his coat, revealing a Los Angeles Police Department uniform, complete with baton and service revolver. Rye took another step back from him. There was no more LAPD, no more any large organization, governmental or private. There were neighborhood patrols and armed individuals, that was all. The man took something from his coat pocket, then threw the coat into the car. Then he gestured Rye back toward the rear of the bus. He had something made of plastic in his hand. Rye did not understand what he wanted until he went to the rear door of the bus and beckoned her to stand there. She obeyed mainly out of curiosity. Cop or not, maybe he could do something to stop the stupid fighting. He walked around the front of the bus, to the street side where the driver's window was open. There, she thought she saw him throw something into the bus. She was still trying to peer through the tinted glass when people began stumbling out the rear door, choking and weeping. Gas. Rye caught an old woman who would have fallen, lifted two little children down when they were in danger of being knocked down and trampled. She could see the bearded man helping people at the front door. She caught a thin old man, shoved out by one of the combatants. Staggered by the old man's weight, she was barely able to get out of the way as the last of the young men pushed his way out. This one, bleeding from the nose and mouth, stumbled into another, and they grappled blindly, still sobbing from the gas. The bearded man helped the bus driver out through the front door, though the driver did not seem to appreciate his help. For a moment, Rye thought there would be another fight. The bearded man stepped back and watched the driver gesture threateningly, watched him shout in wordless anger. The bearded man stood still, made no sound, refused to respond to clearly obscene gestures. The least impaired people tended to do this. Stand back unless they were physically threatened, and let those with less control scream and jump around. It was as though they felt it beneath them to be as touchy as the less comprehending. This was an attitude of superiority, and that was the way people like the bus driver perceived it. Such superiority was frequently punished by beatings, even by death. Rye had had close calls of her own. As a result, she never went unarmed. And in this world where the only likely common language was body language, being armed was often enough. She had rarely had to draw her gun or even display it. The bearded man's revolver was on constant display. Apparently that was enough for the bus driver. The driver spat in disgust, glared at the bearded man for a moment longer, then strode back to his gas-filled bus. He stared at it for a moment, clearly wanting to get in, but the gas was still too strong. Of the windows, only his tiny driver's window actually opened. The front door was open, but the rear door would not stay open unless someone held it. Of course, the air conditioning had failed long ago. The bus would take some time to clear. It was the driver's property, his livelihood. He had pasted old magazine pictures of items he would accept as fair on its sides. Then he would use what he collected to feed his family or to trade. If his bus did not run, he did not eat. On the other hand, if the inside of his bus was torn apart by senseless fighting, he would not eat very well either. He was apparently unable to perceive this. All he could see was that it would be some time before he could use his bus again. He shook his fist at the bearded man and shouted. There seemed to be words in his shout, but Rye could not understand them. She did not know whether this was his fault or hers. She had heard so little coherent human speech for the past 3 years, she was no longer certain how well she recognized it, no longer certain of the degree of her own impairment. The bearded man sighed. He glanced toward his car, then beckoned to Rye. He was ready to leave, but he wanted something from her first. No, he wanted her to leave with him. Risk getting into his car when, in spite of his uniform, law and order were nothing, not even words any longer. She shook her head in a universally understood negative, but the man continued to beckon. She waved him away. He was doing what the less impaired rarely did, drawing potentially negative attention to another of his kind. People from the bus had begun to look at her. One of the men who had been fighting tapped another on the arm, then pointed from the bearded man to Rye, and finally held up the first two fingers of his right hand, as though giving two-thirds of a Boy Scout salute. The gesture was very quick, its meaning obvious even at a distance. She had been grouped with the bearded man. Now what? The man who had made the gesture started toward her. She had no idea what he intended, but she stood her ground. The man was half a foot taller than she was, and perhaps 10 years younger. She did not imagine she could outrun him, nor did she expect anyone to help her if she needed help. The people around her were all strangers. She gestured once, a clear indication to the man to stop. She did not intend to repeat the gesture. Fortunately, the man obeyed. He gestured obscenely, and several other men laughed. Loss of verbal language had spawned a whole new set of obscene gestures. The man, with stark simplicity, had accused her of sex with the bearded man and suggested she accommodate the other men present, beginning with him. Rye watched him wearily. People might very well stand by and watch if he tried to rape her. They would also stand and watch her shoot him. Would he push things that far? He did not. After a series of obscene gestures that brought him no closer to her, he turned contemptuously and walked away. And the bearded man still waited. He had removed his service revolver, holster and all. He beckoned again, both hands empty. No doubt his gun was in the car and within easy reach, but his taking it off impressed her. Maybe he was all right. Maybe he was just alone. She had been alone herself for 3 years. The illness had stripped her, killing her children one by one, killing her husband, her sister, her parents. The illness, if it was an illness, had cut even the living off from one another. As it swept over the country, people hardly had time to lay blame on the Soviets, though they were falling silent along with the rest of the world. On a new virus, a new pollutant, radiation, divine retribution. The illness was stroke swift in the way it cut people down, and stroke-like in some of its effects. But it was highly specific. Language was always lost or severely impaired. It was never regained. Often there was also paralysis, intellectual impairment, death. Rye walked toward the bearded man, ignoring the whistling and applauding of two of the young men and their thumbs-up signs to the bearded man. If he had smiled at them or acknowledged them in any way, she would almost certainly have changed her mind. If she had let herself think of the possible deadly consequences of getting into a stranger's car, she would have changed her mind. Instead, she thought of the man who lived across the street from her. He rarely washed since his bout with the illness, and he had gotten into the habit of urinating wherever he happened to be. He had two women already, one tending each of his large gardens. They put up with him in exchange for his protection. He had made it clear that he wanted Rye to become his third woman. She got into the car and the bearded man shut the door. She watched as he walked around to the driver's door, watched for his sake, because his gun was on the seat beside her. And the bus driver and a pair of young men had come a few steps closer. They did nothing, though, until the bearded man was in the car. Then one of them threw a rock. Others followed his example, and as the car drove away, several rocks bounced off harmlessly. When the bus was some distance behind them, Rye wiped sweat from her forehead and longed to relax. The bus would have taken her more than halfway to Pasadena. She would have had only 10 miles to walk. She wondered how far she would have to walk now, and wondered if walking a long distance would be her only problem. At Figueroa and Washington, where the bus normally made a left turn, the bearded man stopped, looked at her, and indicated that she should choose a direction. When she directed him left, and he actually turned left, she began to relax. If he was willing to go where she directed, perhaps he was safe. As they passed blocks of burned, abandoned buildings, empty lots, and wrecked or stripped cars, he slipped a gold chain over his head and handed it to her. The pendant attached to it was a smooth, glassy black rock, obsidian. His name might be Rock or Peter or Black, but she decided to think of him as Obsidian. Even her sometimes useless memory would retain a name like Obsidian. She handed him her own name symbol, a pin in the shape of a large golden stalk of wheat. She had bought it long before the illness and the silence began. Now she wore it, thinking it was as close as she was likely to come to Rye. People like Obsidian, who had not known her before, probably thought of her as Wheat. Not that it mattered. She would never hear her name spoken again. Obsidian handed her pin back to her. He caught her hand as she reached for it and rubbed his thumb over her calluses. He stopped at First Street and asked which way again. Then, after turning right as she had indicated, he parked near the music center. There he took a folded paper from a dashboard and unfolded it. Rye recognized it as a street map, though the writing on it meant nothing to her. He flattened the map, took her hand again, and put her index finger on one spot. He touched her, touched himself, pointed toward the floor. In effect, we are here. She knew he wanted to know where she was going. She wanted to tell him, but she shook her head sadly. She had lost reading and writing. That was her most serious impairment and her most painful. She had taught history at UCLA. She had done freelance writing. Now she could not even read her own manuscripts. She had a house full of books that she could neither read nor bring herself to use as fuel. And she had a memory that would not bring back to her much of what she had read before. She stared at the map, trying to calculate. She had been born in Pasadena, had lived for 15 years in Los Angeles. Now she was near LA Civic Center. She knew the relative positions of the two cities, knew streets, directions, even knew to stay away from freeways, which might be blocked by wrecked cars and destroyed overpasses. She ought to know how to point out Pasadena, even though she could not recognize the word. Hesitantly, she placed her right hand over a pale orange patch in the upper right corner of the map. That should be right. Pasadena. Obsidian lifted her hand and looked at it, then folded the map and put it back on the dashboard. He could read, she realized belatedly. He could probably write, too. Abruptly, she hated him. Deep, bitter hatred. What did literacy mean to him? A grown man who played cops and robbers. But he was literate, and she was not. She would never be. She felt sick to her stomach with hatred, frustration, and jealousy. And only a few inches from her hand was a loaded gun. She held herself still, staring at him, almost seeing his blood. But her rage crested and ebbed, and she did nothing. Obsidian reached for her hand with hesitant familiarity. She looked at him. Her face had already revealed too much. No person still living in what was left of human society could fail to recognize that expression, that jealousy. She closed her eyes wearily, drew a deep breath. She had experienced longing for the past, hatred of the present, growing hopelessness, purposelessness. But she had never experienced such a powerful urge to kill another person. She had left her home, finally, because she had come near to killing herself. She had found no reason to stay alive. Perhaps that was why she had gotten into Obsidian's car. She had never before done such a thing. He touched her mouth and made chatter motions with thumb and fingers. Could she speak? She nodded and watched his milder envy come and go. Now both had admitted what it was not safe to admit, and there had been no violence. He tapped his mouth and forehead and shook his head. He did not speak or comprehend spoken language. The illness had played with them, taking away, she suspected, what each valued most. She plucked at his sleeve, wondering why he had decided on his own to keep the LAPD alive with what he had left. He was sane enough to know otherwise. Why wasn't he at home raising corn, rabbits, and children? But she did not know how to ask. Then he put his hand on her thigh, and she had another question to deal with. She shook her head. Disease, pregnancy, helpless, solitary agony. No. He massaged her thigh gently and smiled in obvious disbelief. No one had touched her for 3 years. She had not wanted anyone to touch her. What kind of world was this to chance bringing a child into, even if the father were willing to stay and help raise it? It was too bad, though. Obsidian could not know how attractive he was to her. Young, probably younger than she was. Clean, asking for what he wanted rather than demanding it. But none of that mattered. What were a few moments of pleasure measured against a lifetime of consequences? He pulled her closer to him, and for a moment she let herself enjoy the closeness. He smelled good, male and good. She pulled away reluctantly. He sighed, reached toward the glove compartment. She stiffened, not knowing what to expect, but all he took out was a small box. The writing on it meant nothing to her. She did not understand until he broke the seal, opened the box, and took out a condom. He looked at her, and she first looked away in surprise. Then she giggled. She could not remember when she had last giggled. He grinned, gestured toward the back seat, and she laughed aloud. Even in her teens, she had disliked back seats of cars. But she looked around at the empty streets and ruined buildings. Then she got out and into the back seat. He let her put the condom on him, then seemed surprised at her eagerness. Sometime later, they sat together, covered by his coat, unwilling to become clothed near strangers again, just yet. He made rock the baby gestures and looked questioningly at her. She swallowed, shook her head. She did not know how to tell him her children were dead. He took her hand and drew a cross in it with his index finger, then made his baby rocking gesture again. She nodded, held up three fingers, then turned away, trying to shut out a sudden flood of memories. She had told herself that the children growing up now were to be pitied. They would run through the downtown canyons with no real memory of what the buildings had been or even how they had come to be. Today's children gathered books as well as wood to be burned as fuel. They ran through the streets chasing one another and hooting like chimpanzees. They had no future. They were now all they would ever be. He put his hand on her shoulder and she turned suddenly, fumbling for his small box, then urging him to make love to her again. He could give her forgetfulness and pleasure. Until now, nothing had been able to do that. Until now, every day had brought her closer to the time when she would do what she had left home to avoid doing, putting her gun in her mouth and pulling the trigger. She asked Obsidian if he would come home with her, stay with her. He looked surprised and pleased once he understood, but he did not answer at once. Finally, he shook his head, as she had feared he might. He was probably having too much fun playing cops and robbers and picking up women. She dressed in silent disappointment, unable to feel any anger toward him. Perhaps he already had a wife and a home. That was likely. The illness had been harder on men than on women, had killed more men, had left male survivors more severely impaired. Men like Obsidian were rare. Women either settled for less or stayed alone. If they found an Obsidian, they did what they could to keep him. Rai suspected he had someone younger, prettier, keeping him. He touched her while she was strapping her gun on and asked with a complicated series of gestures whether it was loaded. She nodded grimly. He patted her arm. She asked once more if he would come home with her, this time using a different series of gestures. He had seemed hesitant. Perhaps he could be courted. He got out and into the front seat without responding. She took her place in front again, watching him. Now he plucked at his uniform and looked at her. She thought she was being asked something, but did not know what it was. He took off his badge, tapped it with one finger, then tapped his chest. Of course. She took the badge from his hand and pinned her wheat stalk to it. If playing cops and robbers was his only insanity, let him play. She would take him, uniform and all. It occurred to her that she might eventually lose him to someone he would meet as he had met her, but she would have him for a while. He took the street map down again, tapped it, pointed vaguely northeast towards Pasadena, then looked at her. She shrugged, tapped his shoulder, then her own, and held up her index and second fingers tight together, just to be sure. He grasped the two fingers and nodded. He was with her. She took the map from him and threw it onto the dashboard. She pointed back southwest, back toward home. Now she did not have to go to Pasadena. Now she could go on having a brother there and two nephews, three right-handed males. Now she did not have to find out for certain whether she was as alone as she feared. Now she was not alone. Obsidian took Hill Street south, then Washington west, and she leaned back, wondering what it would be like to have someone again. With what she had scavenged, what she had preserved, and what she grew, there was easily enough food for them. There was certainly room enough in a four-bedroom house. He could move his possessions in. Best of all, the animal across the street would pull back and possibly not force her to kill him. Obsidian had drawn her closer to him, and she had put her head on his shoulder, when suddenly he braked hard, almost throwing her off the seat. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw that someone had run across the street in front of the car. One car on the street, and someone had to run in front of it. Straightening up, Rye saw that the runner was a woman, fleeing from an old frame house to a boarded-up storefront. She ran silently, but the man who followed her a moment later shouted what sounded like garbled words as he ran. He had something in his hand. Not a gun. A knife, perhaps. The woman tried a door, found it locked, looked around desperately, finally snatched up a fragment of glass broken from the storefront window. With this, she turned to face her pursuer. Rye thought she would be more likely to cut her own hand than to hurt anyone else with the glass. Obsidian jumped from the car, shouting. It was the first time Rye had heard his voice, deep and hoarse from disuse. He made the same sound over and over, the way some speechless people did. Da, da, da. Rye got out of the car as Obsidian ran toward the couple. He had drawn his gun. Fearful, she drew her own and released the safety. She looked around to see who else might be attracted to the scene. She saw the man glance at Obsidian, then suddenly lunge at the woman. The woman jabbed his face with her glass, but he caught her arm and managed to stab her twice before Obsidian shot him. The man doubled, then toppled, clutching his abdomen. Obsidian shouted, then gestured Rye over to help the woman. Rye moved to the woman's side, remembering that she had little more than bandages and antiseptic in her pack. But the woman was beyond help. She'd been stabbed with a long, slender boning knife. She touched Obsidian to let him know the woman was dead. He had bent to check the wounded man, who lay still and also seemed dead. But, as Obsidian looked around to see what Rye wanted, the man opened his eyes. Face contorted, he seized Obsidian's just-holstered revolver and fired. The bullet caught Obsidian in the temple, and he collapsed. It happened just that simply, just that fast. An instant later, Rye shot the wounded man as he was turning the gun on her. And Rye was alone, with three corpses. She knelt beside Obsidian, dry-eyed, frowning, trying to understand why everything had suddenly changed. Obsidian was gone. He had died and left her, like everyone else. Two very small children came out of the house from which the man and woman had run, a boy and a girl, perhaps 3 years old. Holding hands, they crossed the street toward Rye. They stared at her, then edged past her and went to the dead woman. The girl shook the woman's arm as though trying to wake her. This was too much. Rye got up, feeling sick to her stomach with grief and anger. If the children began to cry, she thought she would vomit. They were on their own, those two kids. They were old enough to scavenge. She did not need any more grief. She did not need a stranger's children who would grow up to be hairless chimps. She went back to the car. She could drive home, at least. She remembered how to drive. The thought that Obsidian should be buried occurred to her before she reached the car, and she did vomit. She had found and lost the man so quickly. It was as though she had been snatched from comfort and security and given a sudden, inexplicable beating. Her head would not clear. She could not think. Somehow she made herself go back to him, look at him. She found herself on her knees beside him with no memory of having knelt. She stroked his face, his beard. One of the children made a noise and she looked at them. at the woman who was probably their mother. The children looked back at her, obviously frightened. Perhaps it was their fear that reached her finally. She had been about to drive away and leave them. She had almost done it, almost left two toddlers to die. Surely there had been enough dying. She would have to take the children home with her. She would not be able to live with any other decision. She looked around for a place to bury three bodies, or two. She wondered if the murderer were the children's father. Before the silence, the police had always said some of the most dangerous calls they went out on were domestic disturbance calls. Obsidian would have known that, not that the knowledge would have kept him in the car. It would not have held her back either. She could not have watched the woman murdered and done nothing. She dragged Obsidian toward the car. She had nothing to dig with her, and no one to guard for her while she dug. Better to take the bodies with her and bury them next to her husband and her children. Obsidian would come home with her after all. When she had gotten them onto the floor in the back, she returned for the woman. The little girl, thin, dirty, solemn, stood up and unknowingly gave Rye a gift. As Rye began to drag the woman by her arms, the little girl screamed, "No!" Rye dropped the woman and stared at the girl. "No," the girl repeated. She came to stand beside the woman. "Go away," she told Rye. "Don't talk," the little boy said to her. There was no blurring or confusion of sounds. Both the children had spoken, and Rye had understood. The boy looked at the dead murderer and moved further from him. He took the girl's hand. "Be quiet," he whispered. Fluent speech. Had the woman died because she could talk and taught her children to talk? Had she been killed by a husband's festering anger or by a stranger's jealous rage? And the children, they must have been born after the silence. Had the disease run its course then? Or were these children simply immune? Certainly they had had time to fall sick and silent. Rye's mind leaped ahead. What if children of 3 or fewer years were safe and able to learn language? What if all they needed were teachers? Teachers and protectors. Rye glanced at the dead murderer. To her shame, she thought she could understand some of the passions that must have driven him, whoever he was. Anger, frustration, hopelessness, insane jealousy. How many more of him were there? People willing to destroy what they could not have. Obsidian had been the protector, had chosen that role for who knows what reason. Perhaps putting on an obsolete uniform and patrolling the empty streets had been what he did, instead of putting a gun into his mouth. And now that there was something worth protecting, he was gone. She had been a teacher, a good one. She had been a protector too, though only of herself. She had kept herself alive when she had no reason to live. If the illness let these children alone, she could keep them alive. Somehow she lifted the dead woman into her arms and placed her on the back seat of the car. The children began to cry, but she knelt on the broken pavement and whispered to them, fearful of frightening them with the harshness of her long unused voice. "It's all right," she told them. "You're going with us too. Come on." She lifted them both, one in each arm. They were so light. Had they been getting enough to eat? The boy covered her mouth with his hand, but she moved her face away. "It's all right for me to talk," she told him. "As long as no one's around, it's all right." She put the boy down on the front seat of the car, and he moved over without being told to make room for the girl. When they were both in the car, Rye leaned against the window looking at them, seeing that they were less afraid now, that they watched her with at least as much curiosity as fear. "I'm Valerie Rye," she said, savouring the words. "It's all right for you to talk to me."
And that was Speech Sounds by Octavia Butler, and I'm joined by Neil Poole. After a brief sojourn away, leaving me to talk to myself on this podcast and abandoning you listeners, because I know you tune in very, very diligently for your Pooley updates. It's great to have you back, Neil, to talk about this one.
Thank you very much, Trev. I've missed you as well.
Lovely. Touching and true on both counts, I think. We have an absolute belter to talk about here today, Matt. A story that centers around feminist hero in many ways, an obvious break from the norms and staples of sci-fi in many other ways, written by a writer who, you know, it took some time for Octavia Butler to be recognized. And when she was, in 1984, this was the story that did it. This story won her a Hugo Award, the first of many she would win. And she went on to write all these series of novels, which deal with some of the most extravagantly interesting themes in the sci-fi genre, and way, way beyond that, if we're being perfectly honest. She looks at things like the structure of society, hierarchies in particular. She looks at the nature of the human, the evolution of the species, or devolution of the species, and what it means for mankind to adapt. She looks at the idea of survivors and the survivor's hero, which is very much what Rai is in this story that we're going to speak about today. She considered alternative societies and societal structures and communities, and quite often with the idea of diversity right at the core of those societies. And she even had a little connection, I don't know how directly, to a wonderful genre called Afrofuturism, which I'll admit was completely new to me until I started looking at what Octavia Butler had written. But this one absolutely hinges, Neil, on the concept of speech, the speech sounds of the title, communication, and the centrality of that to any society, because it's central to any relationship, which is the building block. I think it's fair to say, of society or individual relationships. It's played with in a fascinating way here in this story by Octavia Butler. Relentlessly, she's poking at the wound that's created in this communication breakdown. She's just picking and picking at it until we fully understand how central communication is, verbal and gestural and every kind together, to really fully make up a society. I'm going to go ahead out on a limb and assume that that's really what hit you between the eyes in terms of the message of this story as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the whole idea of communication and language related to society structures, I actually think it goes deeper than that on a personal human level as well. Because one thing that you don't realize but is absolutely true is that when you are working things out in your head, when you are trying to find meaning, or when you are trying to reason in your mind, you are using language to do that. Language are the building blocks to help you establish meaning and to help you establish reason. So to clarify, you can feel an emotion, you know, you can feel fear or you can feel happy, and you're not in that instance using language to come to the conclusion that you feel happy or that you feel sad or whatever. But say you've got like a complex predicament in life where you think, all right, I need to sort this out. What you actually do is you actually use language to break that down. And the better your vocabulary is and the better that you are to use language, then you're able to reason better and create meaning. And so in this story, you have the loss of language, and whether that loss of language be, as you said, reading, writing, or whether it be verbally. But in this story, language has been, because of this virus, language has been taken from people and not used for, you know, a good while. Therefore, people's ability to talk or read or write has gone. But as a consequence of that, what has also gone is their ability to reason, okay? Their ability to find deeper meaning and work things out. And then what you then get is within the individuals, you get this deconstruction, this breakdown almost of what makes us sort of human, and people becoming more animalistic, people becoming more violent, people becoming more instinctive in the way in which they actually act. And then what then happens as a consequence of that, if you've got individuals all doing that, then that actually then impacts on society. And then you've essentially got what you see in this story is civilization beginning to crumble, and not civilization beginning to crumble because there is a virus so much. And this is what I really like about this story. with this type of story, you could go one way, you know, you could have zombie apocalypse, you could have all of this sort of mad stuff and what have you. But this really gets down to, what is it that causes people to abandon, you know, values and morals and to act in what we would think of as a civilized way? And at the absolute bedrock of that is it's all about this loss of language and this loss of therefore an ability to reason. And there's one really little subtle thing at the end of the story, which I think sums this up beautifully. And it's a lovely little bit. You've got a story in which we see lots of adults, all of which have lost the ability to use language or forgotten language. There's a whole thing about memory in this as well. And generally, on the whole, everyone sort of treated each other quite badly. And, you know, people shooting each other, fights on buses, people being jealous of each other and therefore jealous of what abilities others have got in contrast to their disabilities, which is essentially what they are. So you've got that picture of the humans. But then when you get to those two little kids at the end, those two little kids who are unaffected by the virus and, more importantly, still have language and therefore still have a sense of civility. When they get into the car at the end, it's a very little point where the boy moves over and creates space for the girl. And we've had a little bit between Rye and, you know, the policeman. We'll call him, where, you know, there's a bit of kindness that goes on there. But in terms of something a bit like purer, where, you know, one isn't trying to get something from the other, whether it be companionship, there's just that little point at the end where the kids who've still got language, who've still got reason, who've still got civility and have still got the idea of looking out for others, just very naturally moves up on the car seat and lets the girl sit there. Just a really, really nuanced little gesture that I think means so much and really illustrates what this whole story is about, as far as I'm concerned.
I hadn't picked up on that, and you're right. It's one of the little gems that, you know, repeated readings, and if you're more of a listener, repeated listenings will absolutely reward you with this one, because you do pick up more and more each time you go back. And, you know, the centrality of this idea of the communication and what that means to the essence of a society, what that means to the functioning of a society, is, as you've very nicely put it there, it's absolutely so critical to the whole story. And listen, we've spent a lot of time, you and I, in these post-story chats, avoiding any contemporaneous references because, you know, we pretty much decided that we don't want to date these shows. But listen, it's impossible for us to ignore the elephant in the room here, which is, of course, the concept of living with something that is viral and attacking society and the way in which people are communicating on the back of that. And, you know, you'd have to be, I think, sort of a little bit of a benighted soul to read the story and not think a little bit about what we all are currently living with. There are some, you know, outrageously interesting parallels, especially when it comes down to the anger that has crept into discourse in the last 12 months or so. The rage, the impatience, the envy, all of those things that have crept into discourse. And look, I have no interest in discussing people's different views about whatever measures or how people are behaving or any of that. But what I'm just saying is it's impossible to not be aware of hugely powerful echoes from this story from 1984 about an illness that afflicts society and causes people to have a breakdown in their ability to communicate. Now, it's quite literal in this story, Neil, and, you know, the illness itself is quite interesting. We'll come back to that. The specificity of it is quite interesting because it attacks, you know, very specific things, the ability to either read or write, or the ability to speak and understand language. And in Roy's case also, there's a memory impairment, and that's the word that Octavia Butler uses throughout, the impaired. But the symbols of the communication throughout the story, I mean, there's lovely ones. There's the little name symbols that Obsidian and Rye exchange that they wear around their neck to indicate who they are. We have just before that, as she takes a punt and gets into the car, just before she does get into Obsidian's car, there is this horrifying and comical scene of the lads with the absolute implicit threat that they carry, gesturing to each other with all their crude gestures to imply that Rye and Obsidian are off to do the business. The first chat they have with each other is very interesting. And I love this little quote here where, you know, this just tells us a little bit about our central character. It says he touched her and then he pointed to himself and pointed toward the floor, in effect basically saying, we are here. Now, this is where we get to it. She knew he wanted to know where she was going. She wanted to tell him, but she shook her head sadly. She had lost reading and writing. The simplicity of that, Neil, I love it. That was her most serious impairment and her most painful. She had taught history at UCLA. She'd done freelance writing. Now she could not even read her own manuscripts. She had, and all of this, she had a house full of books that she could neither read nor bring herself to use as fuel. And she had a memory that would not bring back to her much of what she had read before. The cruelty of this particular affliction that has leveled the society in which Rye lives, like I say, it's so relevant to today, so relevant to the idea of you cannot have discourse without the sophistication of language. It's impossible. You can have the gestural discourse that we see. You can have even a moment of consensual sex between people just based on gestures and nods and stuff like that. That is not a society. They are moments, individual moments, and you can't join the dots with those. And it's just so brilliantly done by Butler all the way through it that again and again and again, you come to the idea that without language, as you said very eloquently, there is no civil society.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about it is the effect on the behaviour and the way in which it really simplifies and to use as like almost like a work-based management type phrase, it almost streamlines the way in which people interact, where, you know, you get to A to B much quicker. So obviously, in a pandemic now, life has become in some ways, you know, much more simple. There's, you know, three or four rules, you know, stay 2 meters apart, stay in your house, you know, only go here, only go there, only see these people, don't see those people. And it has a very sort of, it has a simplifying effect on the complexity and sort of nuances in life. And that's reflected in a different way, because obviously the nature of the virus is different in terms of the way it affects language. But all in the way in which, for example, Rye and the policeman, you know, get together, and there's almost this expectancy, because one of the men on the bus, you know, the ones who are leering at them and what have you, very quickly he makes a gesture with the two fingers, which we find out means is a coupling. The idea is that, you know, these two people are going to be together, and then within what seems like moments really of them meeting each other and being in the car, you know, very very quickly it goes to them sort of having sex, and then it goes to them, okay, so now we're a couple and you come back and live with me, and you know, we are now a couple and we stay together and we are sort of as one. Now normally in real life, you know, that whole thing, you know, from the beginning to the bit where you're like, you know, you move in and you decide you're gonna share your lives together, would take much much longer than, you know, the length of time that it takes in this. And it's almost like when you strip out the nuances of communication and what nuances of communication can give, where, you know, relationships become more complex. It's like the whole idea of relationships and the whole idea of the way in which you interact with other people just becomes like this uber simple way of behaving, and it happens so much faster and so much quicker. So I would say, yes, it's there as well in probably a more interesting way than what I'm going to go on, but just living through what we're living through at the moment, it is interesting when you see any of these, or you listen to a story or you watch a film or anything that is about viruses and pandemics and contagions and what have you, it is interesting how right all of these like these different forms of art, whether it be, you know, film or literature, get it right. So like in this, just like little things, it's men who are affected most, and then below them it's women who are affected slightly less, and then it's kids who are affected the least and maybe are immune, and so they can get away with it. I mean, that's exactly reflects what has happened in the reality of this virus. And then things like the whole idea of like domestic violence, you know, obviously we see what we think is a real extreme example of domestic violence at the end of this story. And then, you know, you don't have to read the newspapers or the reports that, you know, during this pandemic and lockdowns and what have you, you know, cases of domestic violence have risen and whatever. So it's really interesting in the sort of more conceptual, abstract, behavioral ways. It really mirrors what's happening, you know, what happening now in terms of the way it just simplifies your life. But then just these little specific things, like I've just mentioned, where facts as such or specific circumstances very much relate here in this fiction to what is the reality now. And put it this way, Trev, I really needed the happy ending.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I genuinely do, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about that concept of hope. And just to kind of square circle there as well, you know, you went on to talk about that gesture and that's used by the lads in who've been fighting the sort of, you know, newly sort of unreconstructed males that just sort of grunt at each other. And by the way that's set up is fantastic, because it takes you ages as you're reading, it feels like ages, to realize that these people can't actually speak. It's really cleverly put together by the author. It's really well written in that regard.
Trev, come back to that in a minute. Finish what you're going to say, but I'm really interested in talking about that bit specifically as well, because I think, and that's what I love about this story, I think so much of it is so unbelievably realistic, bearing in mind it's a post-apocalyptic science fiction short story. But apologies, I interrupted you. You finished what you were saying, but let come back to that.
Just the stances of them, the way in which the author just approaches this slow dawning of what's actually happening and why it's happening. I mean, the opening few lines give us a little hint of what it is that's going on and why it's a grim situation. She's been driven out by loneliness and hopelessness, is what it says, and she's gone off to see if she can find some relatives. But the way in which that is built up, the slow dawning that we have as readers, that these lads can't actually speak because they behave in a way that's all too familiar to us. They behave in a way that's all too kind of classically familiar male confrontational behavior. They adapt, as Butler says. I thought it was really, really interesting, the T stance. So they've got their arms out saying, yo, what are you going to do about it? They're grunting at each other, they're pushing and shoving, and it's just a series of, you know, the type of things that we associate with the more brutal end of machismo. And look, I'm just aware that you wanted to jump back in there, so do.
It's pretty much an extension of what you said. I just thought, virus or no virus, language or no language, I thought just a depiction of the way in which a very small incident between strangers, whether it be on public transport, can slowly bubble. And then as you watch it, you know, you sort of sense, oh, this is going to kick off, and you sense that, you know, cranking up and turning the screw on, like the danger. And I think that is realized this really, really perfectly. So I mean, I don't like live, you know, in LA or whatever, but I do live in an urban setting, and this doesn't only have to happen in an urban setting, where, you know, for like 40 odd years I've seen fights like happen, you know, and sort of, and you can see, and you really get to learn the very beginning, the little murmurs of what is going to escalate. And I think the way that's realized is like really good. And what I like about this story is, and maybe this is what you were talking about society as well, I think it's a story that depicts urban life and the dangers and the realities of urban life like really, really well. I mean, I teach, so, you know, like the thing that happens on the bus, and, you know, she's clocking what's going to go on, and she's thinking, this is going to be my move. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do. And she does it, and she's got this really good like hazard perception going on, where she, you know, she's streetwise, she knows people, she knows what people are like in this situation, and she's putting herself in a position to survive this situation, not get embroiled in it and what have you. I actually teach my kids that type of thing, not in like a sort of martial arts way or anything, Trev, but we have a thing we have a thing in our house called Skaldar, right? Okay, where I live, we have a phrase called scallies, and in our house, I think sort of in other places in the city, people might use the word scallies in a more friendly sort of like, oh, scallywag, you know, what a little cheeky rogue. I don't use it like that at all. I use it absolutely negatively and with massive judgment. Okay. All right. So, because I know like the people who will just like sort of jump you or have the shirt off your back or, you know, just like not to trust, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, me and Mrs. Neil teach our kids Scaldar. We've been teaching them this for years. We sort of, and it's not to judge people, but it's like, just be careful of them. Stay away from that. Stay away from that situation. So all of that was like really forefront of my mind when I was reading. I just thought of things as well. You know, like the way essentially they're all jealous of each other, and jealousy inspires violence, and therefore people don't show in this story the gifts that they have. You know, whether, so for example, the, if you can talk, don't talk, because if people see that you've got that thing, they'll get jealous and they'll attack you for it as well. That is my experience and understanding of like urban sort of life as well. So dead quick story. Edit this out if you want, Trev. But for example, years ago, we had neighbours, right? And they had decent cars, but then they left, some new neighbours came. And he bought some like really souped up car, like massively like souped up car, right? Which just doesn't fit round here. Within days, in the middle of the night, you got three masked fellas coming through the door, using their own kitchen knives on them, getting the keys to that car. And it's that idea that's as if, I think when you live in an urban setting where that type of thing has happened, you do keep, like, I'd like to have a much nicer car than I have, but I don't, Trev. I purposely have a crap car, so men in mass don't come into my house in the middle of the night with knives and try and rob my car, because I haven't got a car worth robbing. So I just think this story really, really depicts to me the sort of the danger of an urban life and the violence that surrounds it. And then it's only just exacerbated by the virus that is a catalyst and, you know, makes it even more extreme. I may have got off on one there a little bit, but that's just what really spoke to me in this as well. Not just the idea of this pandemic, but just the depiction of urban life and the danger that sort of like comes with it and the way you have to have your wits about you. That really spoke to me personally.
I think anyone who's lived in a, you know, typical urban scenario will relate to you and Mrs. Neil and the passing on of the Scaldar skills. I mean, it's just a thing that people have to do, especially in a parent, if you're in a parental role. And what I think is really interesting, you've touched off it there, is the way in which, yeah, it's not just the illness, as Octavia Butler refers to it in this story. It's the way in which it exacerbates, again, to use the word you just used, things that were latent in human nature anyway. Right, which is kind of what you're talking about, right? So yeah. If you're going to move into a place and you're going to be flash, you can be pretty sure you're going to attract attention to yourself. It's basic human nature stuff. And the basic human nature stuff comes out, and it's sort of writ large across this entire story. What I love about it is the way in which people have this involuntary reaction to what's going on because of this illness. And it gives them feelings of rage that they can't seem to control. Now, we've all seen, you mentioned earlier on, the zombie apocalypse movies, and they're all sort of filled with a rage they can't understand. This is different. These people, and it's actually really interesting, Rye postulates towards the end of the story, it's possible that maybe this guy who's just literally stabbed the woman to death with a boning knife may have done so because of jealousy over the fact that she could speak, right? And at the start of the story, or pretty much towards the start of the story, when Obsidian is doing his hero bit and trying to sort out the mess with the bus, it's very, very obvious that, you know, the bus driver hates him because he seems to be less impaired than him, yeah. As well as everything else. And there's this little piece there that kind of touches on that, where Butler says the least impaired people tended to do this, which is basically stand still, make no sound in the face of obscene gestures, in the face of provocation. Just to go back to the quote, the least impaired people tended to do this, stand back unless they were physically threatened, and let those with less control scream and jump around It was as though they felt it beneath them to be as touchy as the less comprehending. This was an attitude of superiority, and that was the way people like the bus driver perceived it. Such superiority was frequently punished by beatings, even by death. So it's a no-win, right? If you have the level of understanding to back off and back away from confrontation, it's like the stupid playground scenario we've all been in, where the bully is there and he's saying, "You're looking at my, say, trainers," and you say, "No, I'm not looking at your trainers." "Oh, what, are my trainers not good enough for you?" That type of thing. It's a no-win scenario. There will be violence. It is imminent. And this impairment, illness, has brought out this latent rage that seems to exist. And it's very notable. And look, it's not to take this from a purely feminist land, but it's very notable that the rage is most eminently clear in the young men, in the male characters. It's very notable that Rye is looking to escape from a scenario where her domestic life is looking across at her neighbors, looking across this, what she refers to as an animal of a man who just kind of urinates on every corner. And he's got two women tending to him because literally it's their way of survival and having this sort of animal to protect them. And he's eyeing Rye up as number three. And so it's that hopelessness that drives her out. And that's why it's such a tense scenario when she does sort of take up with Obsidian. And so touching, I think, when they have the interaction they do have. Also, again, just purely from the idea of looking at it as a heroine at the heart of the novel, I think, because we might get a chance to come back to this, I really did enjoy the way the physical intimacy, the sex scene, is delightfully Rye-centric. You know, little details like the butler mentions that what was attractive to her, apart from the fact that he was physically attractive to her, was that he asked for what he wanted. I mean, talk about a little dig into the ribs of the stereotypical male who grasps first and asks later. I thought that was particularly affecting and interesting. Look, we could go on for ages about that, and the rage thing really struck me as particularly interesting. Again, just as well, in the interaction between Rye and Obsidian, the initial one, you see her initial reaction to him is raw jealousy. And she says at one point that she found herself staring at him, almost seeing his blood. No person still living in what was left of human society could fail to recognize the expression that she had, the jealousy. She closed her eyes wearily, drew a deep breath. She experienced longing for the past, hatred of the present, growing hopelessness, purposelessness. And she had never experienced such a powerful urge to kill another person. And this is in our central character, who we admire so much, especially towards the end of the story. It just shows you how, you know, the affliction that has crippled society brings out this resentment and rage in people.
Yeah, entirely. And that's the exact same point that I was going to reference, was her rage and her jealousy. And it's when you read that when it comes to later on, where she sees the husband murdering his wife and then murdering the policeman, that she has that level of empathy. And that's why that empathy then makes sense, because she herself only moments earlier has experienced that really intense jealousy that she perceives might be the reason for why the husband stabs what we think is his wife to death, that it would be just to do it on the basis of jealousy, because she's felt that experience herself. And, you know, she's just been pretty much helped out by this man. Yeah, regardless of that, she still feels this. But what I think maybe sets her apart a little bit is really interesting, and again refers back to the point that you were saying about the man who lives opposite to her, is one of the reasons in which she is happy that the policeman or the bearded man or whatever we want to call him comes back, is because she says if she brings him back, then the man across the road will leave her alone. But that's not the reason in which she's happy. That she doesn't say, "Oh, I'm happy because he'll leave me alone." She actually says something much more poignant. She says, "Maybe I won't have to kill him." So there is, although she has those instinctive feelings of rage which come from the jealousy that she has, you know, when she sees the policeman being able to read and write, ultimately, when she's applying more reason to it, she doesn't actually want to kill anyone. And one of the reasons in which she's happy, not just for herself to be now a couple, she's now thinking, right, I won't have to kill another person here because the man across the road won't try it on now. And therefore, I won't have to, because you sense that she's killed other people before. And we're now in a society where everyone's killing each other all of the time to protect themselves. So there's a couple of like really, I don't know if nice is the word, but a couple of quite clever things going on there, I think.
Yeah, and that feeds exactly into the whole idea that of what an interesting heroine she is in this story. What an interesting sort of perspective that you get from Octavia Butler, from her about her central character and the way she perceives the world. It's refreshing in so many ways. And listen, I want to talk about hope and the end of the story. And I just want to briefly mention the whole dystopian setting here, because obviously it's very much part of it. And then when I'm finished that, if you want to comment on the dystopian stuff, but before we get to hope, then if there's anything you wanted to have as a little insert, you can be thinking about that and I'll cue you up in a second. So if you want to comment on the dystopian stuff straight away afterwards and then segue into whatever you've got or whatever you have that you'd really like to talk about, but just leave the hope as our last topic, because I'm just keeping an eye on the clock here. I know we have a schedule to keep to. But just in terms of the dystopian setting, it would be remiss not to acknowledge it. Of course, I've noticed with the great stories that several people have told me that they actually revel in the stories that are a little bit more sort of grim. And we know Harlan Ellison, who was a great supporter of Octavia Butler in her early days, was responsible for one of the I think you described it as one of the nastiest stories that you've ever read, and I couldn't agree more with that.
This definitely has similarities, doesn't it?
Of
like, you know, the disability and the taking away of things that make us human, and then the insanity that creates. So there's definitely links there, isn't there?
Absolutely. And if one man it was capable of creating a dystopia, it's Ellison in that I have no mouth and I must scream. There are several little nods that I just wanted to mention. I love the idea that there was, we've got Obsidian running around in his uniform, but there's no LAPD anymore. She says, no more any large organization, governmental or private. There were neighborhood patrols and armed individuals. That was it. That's okay. So we're off to a grim start there. I love little details like about the bus driver setup. The bus itself, she says it was the driver's property, his livelihood. He had pasted old magazine pictures of items he would accept as fair on its sides. This is fantastic stuff. So this is how he's adapting to the new world of communication-free existence, pointing at pictures and saying what he will accept as fair or not.
He's still acting like a bus driver, though, Trev. I like that post-apocalypse or not. He's still got the main traits of a bus driver going on there.
And the last thing that leads kind of into the hope topic that I'll get to towards the end with you is the depiction of children. And there's some nice sort of foreshadowing here by Butler, where in the early part of the story, we're told that Rye had told herself that the children growing up now were to be pitied. They would run through the downtown canyons with no real memory of what the buildings had been or even how they had come to be. Today's children gathered books as well as wood to be burned as fuel, communication, right? They ran through the streets chasing one another and hooting like chimpanzees. That's going to come back. They had no future. They were now all they would ever be. And that's a beautiful little bit of foreshadowing and brings us towards a little bit of hope that we come to at the end. So just before we get to that topic, Neil, was there anything else? I don't want to leave any big idea on the table that you specifically wanted to speak about.
I think just coming back to that bit, that's another example, I would say, of just the realities in this story. Because, I mean, what parent with some sort of social conscience and knowledge of what's going on in the world, you know, whatever it may be, doesn't think with their children like, what future have my children got? And I reckon, you know, you could probably take that back hundreds of years, because I'm sure everyone through history thinks the next 100 years aren't looking great here for one reason for another. You could certainly say that now, climate change and whatever. So this is what I'm saying about, I really like this story. There's just loads and loads and loads of little touches in there that are absolutely, yeah, that's what life is like. That's exactly what life is like. Post-apocalyptic virus or not, there's just lots of touches on reality. I've got a question for you, Trev. Now, oh, yeah. If you answer, well, depending on your answer to this, it might blow my theory out of the water. Okay, but I'm still gonna risk it. Her name being Rye. At the end, we find out that her name is it Valerie? Yeah, Valerie Rye. Okay. Yeah. Was that a surprise to you that was her surname, or did you know that was her surname throughout, or did you assume that was her first name?
I absolutely assumed it was her first name as we went through the story, and it was a nice kind of surprise for me, and I'll tell you why, just in case this ties in with yours. It just reminded me, I'm thinking, right, this story is written and comes out in 1984, so I'm thinking, okay, we do have... And Octavia Butler is such an important writer in the sci-fi genre, but just an important writer end of story, because she's pushing all these boundaries and she's putting forth these really interesting characters and this idea of sort of diversity all the way through all her writing. And I've only really read a novel and a half in one of the other series, which is all I could manage to get to between when we decided on this story and now. But it's fascinating stuff. And what came to mind for me, Neil, was Ripley in Aliens, Alien rather. Okay. So you've got this incredibly sort of iconic science fiction heroine who's known by her second name, to the extent that, off the top of my head, and I'm not a sci-fi nerd in the way that an awful lot of people would be. I don't even know what Ripley's first name is. So there you go. So that's what came to my mind. So I found it to be, in some ways, almost a little bit of an extra empowerment to the character that she'd be referred to by her second name in the same way that any male hero might have been. So I kind of like that in a way. What was your theory?
No, that's cool. That's interesting. And my theory is that is a purposeful technique in this story, that we are misled to think that her first name is Rye. And I would hazard the guess that the majority of people, and even though Rye isn't an obvious first name, I still would hazard a guess that most people are led to believe that is her name. And I thought, that if that is true, if that was done purposely, like, which I think it is, I think that's really good in terms of the form there relating to the content of the story and pulling in the reader there, where it literally evidences and exemplifies how easy it is for miscommunication to occur, how easy it is to interpret signs incorrectly, and how easy it is to get these things wrong. And I think when at the end that happens and the reader thinks, oh god, you know, I was wrong there, I didn't read the signs properly here, I think that reflects really well on the world in which people have difficulties reading the signs. And, or like, as a listener, there is no negative outcome for us, but it just shows in which the way it can impact on your way of thinking, and it can make you think the wrong things. And then in this story, by thinking the wrong things and not reading the signs, then it can lead to disastrous outcomes. So I'd like to think that that's there in on purpose, just to draw us in and really make that idea a lot more vivid, essentially.
Oh, I've really enjoyed that, you know. I've really enjoyed that. And it's been at least two or three shows since we've had the Pooley form and content stuff coming out. I do love that. It's actually really, really... And now I really hope Octavia Butler meant it, and having read what I've read from her, I don't doubt it at all. That's really interesting. Let's bring this chat to an end, because, you know, we need to end on the clear up note. That's there, it's deliberate, it's purposeful, it's there for a reason. And just when you've got Rye having sort of secured a scenario for herself where she found a man who could give her forgetfulness and pleasure, it's all within literally moments gone. He's lying there, she's almost nauseous from what she's witnessed, the murder of the stranger, the murder of Obsidian, the fact that she's had to kill the guy who attacked both of the others. And now the children, the bloody picture of the children, the appalling vista of these kids who are shattered and hanging around the dead body of their mother. And of course, all the darkest ideas come back into Valerie Rye's mind about what possible fate kids could have and what would be the point of her doing this. But it's the darkness of what happens that actually brings her to the epiphany or the realization that actually, hang on, I nearly drove off here. I've got to bring these bodies away. I've got to bury them. I've got to bring these kids with me. That's the only hope. That's the only possible thing to do here. And what I love about it, Neil, is that that's rewarded. The decision to do, in inverted commas, the right thing is rewarded in the most beautiful way by the fact that the kids can speak and she can understand them and the three of them can be this lovely little family. Also built into the cake here, baked into the cake, is the idea of the hope that perhaps these are the generation who have grown up and will not be affected. The hope that maybe they have some sort of immunity which others can have as well. So just in simplistic terms, that's a kind of gorgeous ending. It's beautifully constructed, and I love the pacing of it. Just as I say, just as she's made up her mind to do the thing that makes everyone who's reading it feel a little bit better, she gets this beautiful payoff. And you know, there's the little subtleties that you mentioned earlier on with the little gesture from the boy to the girl, the little civilized gesture. That's gorgeous stuff. What was your take on the ending in general, and the theme of hope in particular?
Yeah, as I said, I was so happy for it, because I think you got to take what comes just before to understand why you're so happy about that bit of hope. Because you get the false hope when it's like when Rye and the policeman and they decide to be a couple and they go away, and you know she's happy. She's got some hope. She can personally, hopefully, live a better life. So you get that first burst of hope, and then when you then get this really, really sudden situation where all of a sudden she's surrounded by three corpses, and like, you know, in a second everything's taken away. And it reminded me, you see it loads now. I mean, I know this is from 1983, so it's not copying something recent, but if you watch any film or TV program from the last 10, 15, 20 years, I've lost count of the amount of films and programs I've seen where someone's having a really normal conversation. They stand, they walk into the road, and then all of a sudden a bus sort of truck comes past and runs them over and kills them in a really brutal, shocking, sudden way. I mean, it happens. I swear it's in every film, like at the moment. So I was like, oh, not that sort of cheap shock trick, which I think that is. I think there's a lot of that. It just, you know, it lacks any sort of nuance or sort of class or any real narrative, I think. So when that first happened, I was quite disappointed, because I love that story and thought, oh no, you just got this completely stupid, everyone's dead, nihilism, the end. And it's like, you know, it wouldn't be totally out of keeping with that type of story, but you want something better. So the fact that that isn't the end, and then we get this second burst of hope, and this second burst of hope is much more universal. I think that first one she has is more about, right, I can live my life and have a better life now, and you know, I don't need to go and find and see if I've got any relatives in Pasadena and whatever. It's a little bit more individualistic. The hope at the end is much more universal. There's this whole idea of, you know, kids possibly not being affected. She still benefits from it. She's going to create this nice family unit, and she'll be able to talk, and they'll be able to talk, and everyone's happy and everything. But earlier on, as you said, there's this whole idea that there is no future, that kids don't have any future, that life is no longer worth living. So to finish on that note, where all of a sudden there is a future, there is a reason to carry on for individuals and for like humanity, then yeah, I was very, very happy with that ending. Sometimes I like a dark ending, but at this moment in time, Trev, I very much enjoyed an ending like that, I must say.
Do you know what? I think everybody will have. And honestly, as I was reading it, and I'd read, I think, three stories previous to this. And as I was reading this, I was going, if this ends as bleakly as it's lining up, I'm not even going to ping this one on to Pooley. What's the point? Because, you know, we're all a little bit mentally traumatized at the moment anyway. Some of us have far more reason than others to be because of the way life has panned out over the last while. So yeah, the little bit of hope at the end, I think, is absolutely vital for this one. Even though I know people enjoy reveling in fictional misery, I do like the payoff of that. Not that there wasn't ample fictional misery anyway for you in this one, if you wanted to revel in that too. Listen, we should start wrapping it up, Neil, because it's such an interesting story. I feel like if we go down another rabbit hole, it'll be another 15-minute chunk, and I want to leave people with a reasonable amount of time to be listening. This is episode 26, folks, and it's absolutely fantastic to have Neil back in tandem again, because whereas I was only too delighted to keep the show going and doing story only episodes, an awful lot of people have just commented that it does make the difference. It is the icing on the cake. It was particularly gratifying to hear from people that I know very well, who've listened to it, including my best mate Al, who's listened to it and said that he really enjoys the contributions there of yourself, young Pooley. So it's
always liked Al, Trev. Always,
I know you have. I know.
He's my
know.
Favorite of your friends, I would say. I don't know who Al is.
He's a good lad, and he's got it right there, is what I'm saying. Because, you know, it is absolutely a critical part of the show. So it's lovely. It's lovely to be back doing the show proper. This is episode 26. We will be doing up as far as episode 30. Probably, if we're being realistic, 40 in what it will be season 2. But there is a little bit of a development pulley that I just want to drop on the listeners and yourself, because
surprise,
a tremendous man, a friend of mine from Australia, Nebenid Hamu, has been working away in the background. And to be fair to the man, this has been ready for ages. And it was just because you weren't on board and the show wasn't the show without you that I didn't want to say anything about it until we were up and running back properly again. And now we are. We now have a website. And it is greatstoriespod.com. Neb has put it together for us. It's going to be a place where the episodes can live individually, away altogether from any of the podcast providers. So that in and of itself is going to be a very interesting and good thing for us long term. But it'll also provide links to, if you want to listen to it on iTunes or Spotify or wherever. But ultimately, we'll be able to do that and have it as a landing spot for all our stuff. What I'm loving about the website, and this is where we're going to, you and I have a chat about how we can maximize it. Are we going to include some articles? Will we write an occasional newsletter? Will we have transcripts of the show, stuff like that? All of which is becoming more and more eminently possible with some of the brilliant apps that are coming out now in what's called Podcasting 2.0, something I'm keeping a very, very close eye on. Will we have little art and other links for people to go and enjoy the stories?
I'm looking at it, Trev. I'm looking at it. I've got it up here.
It's a wonder, man. It's a wonder.
You're the dark horse, Trev.
But what we've, well, that's all down to Neb. There is one important piece of information about the website that I want to make everyone aware of, because if this is to be a going thing, a going concern for us as we move forward, we have reached the sort of threshold where hosting and various other costs, and we do want to step it up, if we're being perfectly honest, on so many different levels, and we can do that with quality if we were in a position to do it. So you now have the capacity, should you so wish, to support the show. Now, let me explain to you what I'm thinking of doing. What I'm thinking of doing is going along the lines of some other shows that I've seen, where they have a value for value type of thing. So it's not going to be about, you know, if you want to hear the show, you'll have to pay for it. Or if you want to hear the second hour of the show, you'll have to pay for it. For now, what I'm going to pursue is an idea that, just if you're inclined, maybe you can contribute what you think that episode or show is worth to you. There are different ways that you can sign up. Of course, they'll be there, but you don't have to do that. And the concept is, if you're in a position to do so, it would be greatly appreciated, and it won't turn into a begging shop at the end of every show. That's not going to be the case. I will introduce the topic over the next few weeks and introduce the concept over the next few weeks in this section, just so people know what they're looking at, because I want to point people towards the website. But then we'll be able to take, it would be a position where we'll be able to take on some extra little projects. And I do have loads of ideas, bespoke stories, individual stories for people who become members, that type of thing. So lots and lots of potential. The potentiality is huge. We want to do lots of swap casts with podcasts who've got big listenerships over the next while. I've got three lined up already.
Trev, so do you want to go on a Def Leppard pod?
I would love to go on a Def Leppard.
I'll have you on. I'll have you on.
That, you see, right there, that's what we're talking about. This is the kind of thing we're talking about. So hopefully this is all exciting stuff, which is to come. I didn't want to let another show go past without acknowledging Neb. The work he's done there is tremendous. I appreciate it immensely, and I know Neil does too. And we're only starting to understand what that means for us. It would be daft to let it go another show without letting people know that it exists. So let's start wrapping it up. We will be back with another belter for you next week. But in the meantime, as ever, for another brilliant show, thanks very much.
Thanks, Trev.